What's up, everyone, and welcome to the weekly edition of ESG Now, where we cover how the environment, our society, and corporate governance affects and are affected by our economy. I'm your host, Mike DiSebato, and this week we discuss what the record rise in temperatures mean for the world and the people that invest in it. Thanks, as always, for joining us. Stay tuned. We are living through the hottest days on Earth in its modern history. Heat across the globe has been shattering temperature records from North America to the Antarctic. And scientists are saying there are two main reasons for this. One, you might expect, continued emissions from heat-trapping gases, mainly caused by humans burning oil, gas, and coal. But the second is the return of the cyclical weather pattern called El Niño. Regardless, every country has been hit with deadly heat waves throughout June and continuing into July. Basically, all of India, across Mexico, the southern United States, China, each areas have seen deaths due to the heat, and each have had their infrastructure tested due to the temperatures. Now, the entire media landscape seems to have been talking about this situation en masse, as to be expected and as they should. But you know who isn't talking about it as much? Investors. You don't see the market freaking and tanking because of these heat waves. And to be fair, or to put that into context, the market isn't appropriately reacting to a lot of the physical risks that we now face. There isn't enough that we have done to price in negative externalities or the costs created for our society by polluting companies into the market, and so they're just not reacting to these huge problems. But today, we are going to focus on the problem of extreme heat, because my colleague and guest today, Matthew Lee, has been researching the subject with a number of our colleagues and just published a blog titled Mapping Extreme Heat Costs for the World's Largest Cities, where he quantified some of the risks certain urban areas and sectors face due to extreme heat. So today I called up Matthew and asked him to frame the problem for me, and he started by giving me the scale of the problem of extreme heat.
A recent NASA study has warned us that in a 3-degree world, right, we're on a 2.6, 2.8 trajectory right now. The hottest day we're used to today in summer is going to be 30 to 50 days of summer towards the latter part of the century. So that's the type of broader change we need to be thinking of. And there's also not some sort of carbon price equivalent per degree of temperature or whatnot, right? It's no longer about trying to internalize some externality in the future or create some market around it. The externality has appeared and it's materializing today. It shows up throughout the economy through different types of costs. At least, let's say, three layers. You have direct business disruptions, infrastructure degradation, and broader macro stresses that are put on the economies.
Let me take you through each of those different costs that Matthew just mentioned. Direct business disruptions would be like if you're a construction company that needs added protection for your workers due to the heat. New research by the Public Policy School at the University of California has found that on days when temperatures were between 85 degrees and 90 degrees Fahrenheit, the overall risk of global workplace injuries was 5 to 7% higher than days when the temperatures were in the 60s. When temperatures tops 100 degrees Fahrenheit, the overall risk of injuries was 10 to 15% greater. Then there is the infrastructure degradation, the bulking of the railroads, roads melting, air conditioner units breaking down, power lines breaking down, the destruction of the grid. Let me give you another example, because those are always good to kind of wrap your head around these massive problems. There were the recent heat waves in India and Pakistan that led to rolling blackouts of up to 18 hours, and that was because of energy demand for air conditioning spiked and the grid could not handle it. You also have the macroeconomic challenges that are created when the high heat mixes with other factors, like the heat-fueled wildfires in Canada that forced major drillers like Chevron and Paramount Resources to shut down the equivalent of at least 240,000 barrels of oil a day. Or you have the evaporated rivers caused by heat waves that cripple power plants and shipping, or decreased yields in agriculture due to drought furthered by heat waves, or the elevated healthcare costs from higher rates of diseases and heat health effects. That's basically everything. I went through almost all the sectors. So are we saying that investors should be freaking out about everything? Well, no, but a good place to start would be for investors to map how exposed to extreme heat the most important assets of the companies that they invest in, how exposed those are, look at that, and then take it from there.
We have our asset location database. It's about 400,000 company locations. And it's not just these coordinates. It also gives us the type of building and the size of building that are a part of these companies' assets. And what we can then do is using a revenue allocation model that thinks about what type of business this company is involved in, as well as what type of facility and the information we have on it, we can start distinguishing which assets are more important to their productivity, like a large manufacturing factory and whatnot, towards a business's revenue. And so once we've done that allocating out, we can think about where you're operating, what type of heat you're dealing with, and how important or critical could that be to your operations.
Okay, so let's break that down into a pinpoint example. Say you are invested in CenterPoint, a publicly traded utility that has locations all over the US, but it's headquartered in Texas, which is really hot right now. So it makes a good example. And we can see that if we look at our asset location database and we look at where CenterPoint has its facilities, we can see that there is one that is most exposed to extreme heat risks, and that is one located in a specific area of Houston, Texas. Now, interestingly, the second most exposed facility is located in Dykesville, Wisconsin. How about that? But anyway, you could do that as an investor. You could piece together your portfolio by asset location. Now, another way to do it would be to look at areas of high economic activity and see which of those areas might be most impacted by heat waves and see how exposed you are to those areas. Now, this is what Matthew did. He looked at cities and their exposure to heat.
Most of the world's population and economic activity is occurring right now in cities and continues to urbanize. Actually, I think I read a World Bank report that by 2045, 70% of the world's population and 80% of economic activity will be in urban areas. This could be not only a region that's or a type of area that's very exposed to extreme heat due to like the urban heat island effect, but also a place where people should be looking for opportunity in terms of adaptation investments for the savvy investor. And when we looked at cities, we decided to take the 10 largest in terms of GDP by PPP as a set to start and just see what the change in heat days was like. So these are cities like New York, London, Los Angeles, Seoul, Shanghai, Moscow, and Beijing. And what we found was that on average, these cities will have about 12 more heat days a year by 2050, which is not that far off compared to today. So again, that's two more weeks of extreme heat there on average. And another way we also looked at this was to compare, because the number of heat days, sometimes it can be tricky to place like how much one should read into that. And maybe one extra heat day in Jakarta, Indonesia, is not as significant as one in a much colder city like Helsinki in Finland, right? So another way we looked at it was through what we call regional hazard percentiles. So all that means is just to give folks a better idea of where relatively across the world, and this is regional, this isn't based on company, this is based on a global data set, right? How much hotter compared to the rest of the world this area is becoming locally. And so there we did see some interesting changes across some cities like New York, where today they're not above the 50th percentile in terms of heat days experience, right? So they're below average on balance, but they move above that in a 3-degree scenario. And in fact, they're at a spot where Honolulu, Hawaii's percentile is today, which is, I don't think we would usually associate those two cities in terms of their climate patterns, but yeah, that is the world we could be looking at in a 3-degree scenario.
Again, all those findings are laid out in that blog that Matthew and actually a colleague named Anna Gavek wrote together. And in New York versus Honolulu, the example that they show and that Matthew just talked about, that's just one example that they have in there. Shanghai is another one. And Shanghai might see the most increase in extreme heat days in 2050 compared to 2022. And that's regardless if we keep warming to just 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, or we go up to 3 degrees. Now, Beijing is a close second for that 3-degree scenario. But what's surprising is Paris. Paris has, of the cities that they show, the third most chance of having more extreme heat days than they do right now. And now that might not be surprising for everyone, but I just didn't think of Paris as a place more susceptible to extreme heat than anywhere else. Now, what I was not surprised about was to see that London was the least likely to see an increase and be affected by extreme heat. But, you know, that's London. Everybody might assume that. And really, what you want to take away from Matthew's and other individuals' research that Matthew and his colleague Anna used for this report is we may be looking at trillions of dollars of economic damage due to the increases in extreme heat days around the world if we keep emitting like we are and temperatures keep rising above pre-industrial levels. And now, that trillions of dollars, that's just the direct costs of warming. That doesn't include the indirect costs, like the bulking infrastructure, or prolonged droughts, or agricultural devastation. All that anxiety-inducing stuff. Now, of course, these costs shift dramatically depending on how much our world can mitigate climate change by cutting emissions. But we are already really close to the 1.5 degree warming scenario, and we haven't even started cutting emissions yet at the scale we need to. So there's going to be adaptation costs that we're going to have to deal with due to extreme heat and due to other problematic physical risks that climate change is going to exacerbate. But for extreme heat, I wanted Matthew to take me through what he could about those costs for adaptation that we might incur soon.
There's definitely different scales of action that need to happen across actors. So if it's just you or me that live in a city, the individuals, we do need to start thinking more about planning ahead. So whether that's just even getting some early warnings about heat waves, but also reminding ourselves if we're ready for power outages and what shelter options are available. But for companies, this probably means re-examining or starting to develop some safety protocols for your workers, right? And defining for your business, what are certain thresholds where you might have to change to a different type of work pattern or anticipate some sort of business disruption because, you know, people can't get in to work or whatnot. And what sort of modified patterns are you going to have to work with? The bigger, and when we think about investments again, where the bigger decisions need to be made, that's going to be on the infrastructure side, where in some cases, it's going to be improving the resilience. So that's just making sure that your infrastructure can withstand some slightly higher tipping points. So usually that's, for example, on the energy grid, that's simply bringing in some more batteries so you can deal with some higher spurts of power demand. But in some cases, like cities that don't have a lot of cooling infrastructure built out in their buildings right now, this might call for a bigger adaptation investment. This might call for a lot of retrofits, some reimagining of how buildings and housing is constructed to accommodate for more and more efficient cooling.
This is tough because the cost of these adaptations is going to depend on how quickly we mitigate carbon emissions. If you look at the various scenarios we use to help calculate some of our forward-looking physical risk models, you see that as time goes on, our world's inactivity just makes the price tag for dealing with climate-related events such as heat waves, but also hurricanes, droughts, excessive rainfall, all that. We actually look at 10 types of physical risk scenarios in our models, but the price of dealing with all that increases for each year of inactivity on our part. And right now, the market really hasn't had to think about adaptation in a proactive way. In a reactive way, sure, but not in a proactive way. Mitigation, trying to invest in processes that cut emissions, that has dominated climate finance. The Climate Policy Institute puts mitigation finance at 90% of total climate finance in 2021. And that is likely going to change as the globe continues to react to climate change and we continue to see these once-in-a-lifetime events become more of a chaotic everyday phenomenon that we have to deal with. And I mean that in a dire, sort of fearful way, but also, since ESG can in part, for some, be about financial materiality, I mean that in the opportunistic way for investors. There's going to be a need for a low-carbon solution for cooling homes, a solution that isn't reliant on the mass use of fossil fuels and destructive coolants and refrigerants. Those type of tools will need investment behind them because we are continuing to emit, and our world is going to continue to react to those emissions, and we need to figure out a way to adapt and to mitigate them, and we need to do that soon. And that's it for the week. I want to thank Matthew for discussing the news with me with an ESG twist. I want to thank you so much for listening. If you like what you heard, don't forget to rate and review us. That really helps. And subscribe if you want to hear Bentley and I each week. Thanks again. Talk to you soon.
The MSCI ESG Research Podcast is provided by MSCI Inc. subsidiary, MSCI ESG Research, LLC, a registered investment advisor, and the Investment Advisors Act of 1940, and this recording and data mentioned herein has not been submitted to, nor received approval from the United States Securities and Exchange Commission or any other regulatory body. The analysis discussed should not be taken as an indication or guarantee of any future performance, analysis, forecast, or prediction. The information contained in this recording is not for reproduction in whole or in part without prior written permission from MSCI ESG Research. None of the discussion or analysis put forth in this recording constitutes an offer to buy or sell or promotional recommendation of any security, financial instrument, or product or trading strategy. Further, none of the information is intended to constitute investment advice or recommendation to make or refrain from making any kind of investment decision and may not be relied on as such. The information provided here is as is, and the user of the information assumes the entire risk of any use it may make or permit to be made of the information. Thank you.